Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 116 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by the usual co-hosts. First, we have David Vanderhoof. David, welcome back.
Thanks, Max. Glad you guys missed me a little bit last week, and I had a really good week, and this should be an interesting show, considering I was running around a flight line all last week, so glad to be back.
Right, that's at the Oceana Air Show. That's where you were last weekend, correct?
Yes, sir.
And so we're going to look forward to some great interviews that you recorded at that show.
It was a fantastic show, and the staff at Oceana, the public affairs office, were fantastic to me. Shot over 1,500 pictures over the weekend.
Wow.
And was up front and got to meet lots of great people. So the interviews should show that.
What a blast. Sounds great. Also here is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hey, good evening, and welcome to everyone from beautiful downtown Chicago.
How's everything
it's
over?
It's a balmy 52 degrees, I think, or something.
Yikes. Summer's over, huh?
Yeah, it's gone.
So what's going on over at Jetwine these days? Anything exciting?
Well, I don't know. Little of this, little of that. You know, trying to keep busy writing poignant pieces to stir the minds of those in the aviation industry.
Great. Well, you've got a knack for drumming up controversy.
Yeah. And as it's funny, as my daughter was just telling me the same thing, she said, "Do you try to be annoying?" And I said, "No, I actually don't. It just
comes out.
Kind of happens."
Wow, that's great. That's a fantastic skill. Also, here
that's
is
just a great compliment.
Wow. Yeah. Auto annoy. That's what we call it.
Auto annoy.
Yes.
Also with us is Dan Webb from the Things in the Sky blog. Hi, Dan.
Hey, everyone. Good evening.
How's school going? Taking any exciting classes relevant to a future career in aviation?
I am taking a couple of good finance courses. I am starting my supply chain minor, so we'll see how that goes. So, who knows?
What kind of a class do you take as a supply chain minor? What would it be called?
How to fix Boeing.
I believe the first, this is the first course, that would be Intro to Supply Chain Management, which I'm guessing might be slightly disappointing name in terms of excitement, but yes.
And so if any young ladies are listening and they say, "Oh my God, I always wanted to know someone that was a supply chain major," I mean, they're probably going to be sending their pictures in.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I am not holding my breath on that one, actually.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's probably wise. All right. Well, this episode is going to be a little bit different from the usual format.
Why is that, Max?
Well, because instead of a guest, we have a rather nice and extensive collection of interviews and recordings. Some of them are by us geeks, and we also have some from some of our listeners. So it is going to prove to be exciting, I hope, and quite a bit different. So we have a recording by a math teacher. His name is Kimon, who took some students on a zero-G flight. And I have an interview with Carl Dietrich, the co-founder and CEO of Terrafugia, a little short interview. And as we mentioned, David has quite a number of interviews from the Oceana Air Show. We're looking forward to that. And also Peter Johnson has another Across the Pond installment. So we're going to look forward to those.
Dan, did you bring anything with?
I got nothing.
Just Dan.
No, me neither. So I just...
I have warm and fuzzy thoughts. I don't know.
That's all I have. So we'll see how it goes.
All right. Well, coming up, we're also going to have David's This Week in Aviation and, of course, the Australia Desk Report from Steve and Grant. But first, why don't we get started with a little aviation news? Are you guys ready?
So ready.
Ready.
Our first story comes from the New York Times. This is Airline Trade Group lifts profit forecast. Well, the International Air Transport Association, IATA, has taken another look at what airline industry profits are looking like, and they've actually tripled their profit forecast for this year to $8.9 billion. That's profit for all of the world's airlines. Now, they're not sure that this is going to be able to be sustained. And next year, they're actually looking for a decrease down to around $5.3 billion. But this year, 8.9, three times above what I think they projected in, I think it was June. But, you know, on the surface of it, that sounds good, right?
Yes.
It's a heck of a change in just a couple of months, actually, though.
It is. You kind of wonder how they could be so far off, but...
Well, that's kind of what I was wondering when I read this. I don't know if they're being a little outlandish now or if everybody is trying to avoid that second recession we keep hearing about.
Well, the interesting thing, though, is I did break this down by region, and a lot of this profit is coming Asia-Pacific.
Right.
There, that profit is $5.2 billion. Profit's basically everywhere except, I believe, Europe. I did revise the forecast up. It's a loss of $1.3 billion instead of $2.8 billion. But they're saying, you know, European economy is still weak, and basically the same thing with 2011 is, the economy still isn't great. So the regions like Asia, Middle East, South America, they're saying they'll remain strong, mm-hmm. but you know.
Well, there's another aspect.
The recession's over, but you know we're not really recovering quickly. I mean, is the bottom line, I feel.
Right. There's a couple of comments I would make. One is if you look at the airline profits over the last, say, 10 years, $8.9 billion sounds like a lot. But, you know, in terms of what's the net been, when you take a look at all the losses, you know, the airlines are still not in great shape. That's one point. But another is that $8.9 billion of profit for 2010, that's off of a revenue number of $560 billion. So revenue is strong, but when you look at that profit as a percentage of revenue, it's under 2%. It's 1.6%. That is
not exactly a healthy margin.
Not at all. So, you know, the headlines all read $8.9 billion, but this is not very strong at all.
Yeah, but when was it ever better? I mean, when was it ever astounding? I mean, the airline industry has never been a performer. Never, has it?
The 50s?
Yeah, perhaps.
Well, but I guess everything was regulated then. So, right. It's not exactly the same business model.
I guess we wax romantic maybe, and you know, my memory is a bit fuzzy, but maybe mid-late 90s during the dot-com boom, mm-hmm. everyone was happy. And the other thing that they had noticed is that we're still not exactly where we were. For example, yields, they're reporting still about 8% below the recession. So
we're not there yet.
It's basically, this has been, I think, the picture for the past few months is, you know, we're making improvements, but there's still a way to go. And we'll see. I mean, the past few months, we've seen some really strong numbers from airlines, but we're now starting to, I believe the phrase that I've heard that I like is lap the recovery. The ATA had their yield report out, and basically for American carriers, I mean, yields are continuing to improve, but at a slower rate. And part of that is just because the comparisons are getting harder.
And the other wild card still exists is, fuel costs. This points out, yes, that fuel costs still represent about a quarter of the operating costs. So even small changes in the price of fuel, either way, I think would affect net profits, fairly strongly.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's move on to the next story. This is from the Dallas News. American Airlines eagle to trim departures from San Juan. It looks like American Airlines, and I guess more specifically American Eagle, they're making cuts in their service from Puerto Rico, from San Juan. Dan, they're looking, according to this article, to focus their efforts on large cities.
About a year ago now, I think it was November last year, if I recall correctly, American's been big lately on their cornerstone strategy. So focusing on five markets, Chicago, New York, Miami, Dallas, and L.A. And they're trimming down San Juan, which has never been a huge hub. I believe the article says in 2001 it was up to 135 flights. But they are reducing a few flights, and it kind of makes sense, I think. But for mainline flights up to the lower 48, they'll be dropping flights to Boston, Philly, Tampa, Baltimore, Dulles. And actually, these are, I mean, obviously all non-cornerstone markets. And also, there's competition on all of them. In Boston, you have JetBlue. Philly, you have U.S. Airways, Tampa. Actually, what's interesting, a little over a week ago now, actually within 15 minutes of each other, JetBlue and AirTran announced San Juan Tampa service, with AirTran starting in May AirTran starting in April, and JetBlue starting in May, with one flight and adding additional in June, I believe. And then Baltimore, you have AirTran, and at Dulles, you have United. So kind of just fleeing from the competition in a way. And actually, the only market that's staying is Hartford, where there's no competition, but also, at least the way I'm reading the DOT data here, seems to, of those non-cornerstone markets, appears to have the highest yields. So that makes sense. And also has, again, this is me estimating, and the DOT data is only a 10% sample. But it looks, it also has a over about 70% of the passengers are actually traveling between, Hartford and San Juan. And then they're cutting a few Eagle flights as well, to Anguilla, a couple places in the Dominican Republic, city in Trinidad, Port-au-Prince, and Nevis. I think what basically is happening here, for those cities in the Caribbean, all but two have service to other American hubs, primarily Miami. So my theory here is that a lot of the flights that are being cut had a decent amount of connecting traffic that American can now instead just route through Miami or another hub instead of San Juan. That's my theory. So, and you know, keeping certain routes, obviously keep the San Juan regional routes that are profitable, keep, you know, Hartford, I'm assuming, would be profitable if they're keeping it and also has, you know, decent yields. So, I mean, this is part of the cornerstone strategy, and we'll see if that strategy works. I mean, it was announced about a year ago and they're implementing it. But American, you know, is, I'd say, not in the best place of all the carriers. I mean, they've been saying this for a while, that they're at a cost of advantages to their network peers, because partially because they did not go through bankruptcy earlier this decade, and they have higher labor costs. And I guess eventually, as other carriers renegotiate contracts, their labor costs could go up possibly, but you can't really rely on that happening. You know, you can't exactly plan on that. Actually, their revenue forecast for the third quarter kind of disappointed investors this week. So, you know, okay, we'll see how it goes.
But they're not parking airplanes because of this, are they?
As far as I know, no. I'm actually hoping to get more details on this from American, but I have yet to hear back from them.
And the routes that they're walking away from, they're not going to be hurting. There's sufficient capacity out there already so that the passengers
all the routes that are being cut, all the mainline routes that are being cut to the lower 48 have competition, or except with the exception of Tampa, but there will be competition by the time American leaves. As for the intra-Caribbean flights, I'm a bit less sure on that. And we'll see if it opens up an opportunity. I mean, actually, a carrier that has a nice little operation at San Juan is Cape Air. I have no idea if this creates an opportunity for them or not, but who knows. Okay. But they have a bunch of little 402s just hopping around the Caribbean. It's kind of cute. Well, not cute, but, well, it's a cute little airplane.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, in a meeting way.
Yeah. Okay, next item comes from PR Log. This is Boeing issues forecasts for pilot hiring and airliner purchases. Basically, Boeing has forecasted pilot demand for the next 20 years, and they say that the industry will need 23,300 new pilots per year, which means that over the 20-year period, that's almost 500,000 pilots. They say the largest increase will be in the Asia-Pacific region, and that'll represent about a third of the total. But, I mean, 20 years is a long time, but 500,000 pilots? That's a huge number.
I believe we can cut that in half if Michael O'Leary gets his way, so.
Yeah, that's right.
But you know what they don't say? They don't say where those people are coming from.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very easy to say. It's like the space program. I mean, perhaps, well, maybe that's a bad example, but if they required certain specific engineering skills.
Right.
It's one thing to say, this is what we're going to need, and it's coming, and if you were really a bright kid, I guess you could be ready for that. But in general, you know, where's the motion behind the group to get them ready for these kinds of jobs? And nobody's, you know, that's what this crazy fact committee that the DOT put together mm-hmm. is driving me so crazy about, because they're not even addressing this issue either. And how you can address the future of the industry without talking about where 500,000 pilots are coming from
right.
is just, that's just beyond me.
And it's not just pilots. This forecast from Boeing also looked at maintenance
yes.
Workers, and the number is actually larger, 600,000 new maintenance workers in the next 20 years. So, you know, between that and the pilot demand, I mean, this paints a picture that, gee, if you're the least bit interested in aviation or in flying, becoming a pilot or a mechanic, I mean, this is the time to start planning your career. But,
well, but you actually, know, one issue they're missing too is that they're not talking about the pay scales, and the pay scale and the cost of training for individuals is, I mean, the pay scale is low to start with, the cost of training is high, and that's another conundrum that they haven't figured out yet. I mean, why would when Dan quits school pretty soon and decides that he doesn't want to be an analyst anymore and he wants to be a pilot, where's he going to come up with the 75 or 100 grand he needs to train for that?
Right.
And then the answer is mom and dad. Begging, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. But then, you know, those first jobs. I mean, you know, that's why I'm so curious about all these changes going on in the regional airline industry, because without those jobs, those are sort of the starting point, and they don't pay very much. They don't pay very well either. And so the connections are just not there right now for people to be motivated to want to become pilots, at least not here in the States.
Hmm.
I have two questions, and I don't think, at least from the press release, it doesn't seem that Boeing distinguisher, maybe I was reading it wrong, is in a region like North America, how much of these new pilots, is that just, you know, are some of those just replacing older pilots through attrition or...
Right.
Or, you know, like, how much is this growth? And the other thing, this could be a good question next time we have John Ostrar on with maintenance, just because I'm completely ignorant in this area. Do composite airliners really change? What does that change maintenance-wise in terms of training or what have you?
Yeah, it definitely would be different. Not only in terms of training, but also in terms of processes and equipment required for materials required for maintenance and repairs. So yeah, no, that's a good point. That opens up a whole new branch of the maintenance pie. All right. Well, speaking of John Ostrower, the next item comes from John's blog from Flight Global. Boeing patent may provide glimpse into 737 replacement plan. I find this extremely interesting. Basically, a patent that has been around or was filed in November last year in 2009. Looks at an airplane that might be a possible replacement for the 737. Now, we've characteristically referred to the 737 as a single aisle or a narrow body, but this approach is quite a bit different. In fact, it kind of looks like a short, porky kind of an airplane. That's a twin aisle, actually, seven abreast.
Can we say porky?
I think we could say porky. You think that's okay?
I don't know. I don't want any letters from any rookie yeah. listeners.
Well, this thing has, like I say, two aisles. It's seven abreast. Seating would be 232. A composite body, most likely aluminum wings, we see in this article, and with an elliptical cross section that's sort of horizontally elliptical. And it's kind of a little difficult to tell exactly what the patent is all about. It may really be about the construction methods that would allow you to create a composite fuselage of this sort of shape and configuration. It's certainly a lot different than a 737.
But, you know, let me ask, in fact, any of you guys, I mean, you probably saw that note that Mr. Anderson from Delta let go with last week that said that it was time Boeing realized it needed to re-engine the 737.
Yes, yeah.
And that they needed it. I mean, how does that kind of line up to you, Dan, with what we just heard in this little clip?
A good question.
But basically, so, what he said is that they need to re-engine the 737. I mean, it's no more point in just talking about it. It needs to happen.
And right.
So I just thought that was kind of odd because
did he say the same thing about the A320 by any chance?
I don't think he did. I think he just mentioned the 737, which I thought was even more odd.
Well, because I'm just looking for hints here because since obviously they've been all Boeing but Northwest with being an Airbus customer. That's interesting. I mean, Delta is a big player, large fleet of 737s. But, well, I think the issue is that, from what I've heard, is just re-engineering the 7.3 is difficult, just height-wise. I'm not sure what he would think about, because I know John Ostrower, we really are the John Ostrower fan club, about the potential, what did they call it? Anyone remember the 737? It's not the NG, but it's like the G.
Yeah, the extra or
yeah,
something like that. Yeah, I mean, this is a tough issue for Boeing, certainly. I mean, the 737 wing height is lower than the A320 series, and so you have less clearance. The newer, more efficient jet engines being developed have larger diameter fans, so that is potentially an issue for a 737 re-engining. So the question has been, is Boeing going to re-engine, or is Boeing going to come out with something altogether new?
And my question is, with this patent, is when could this possibly come out?
Yeah. Yeah. Timing, of course, is a big issue.
So, and the other interesting thing is you assume the Delta would be replacing long-term, eventually the 737-800. I mean, they only have a handful of 700s. So if they're looking for that, I don't know exactly how many they see, but that 150 to 170 seating range, I mean, that kind of counts out new players like the C series. I mean, I think the C-Series, if you jam them in, could, you know, start approaching 150, but you assume the Delta would have a first class in there. So that's really, really interesting.
Actually. Well, and in fact, now that I mention it, I do remember the story did mention the C-Series. Maybe this is a way to get a little leverage with the folks in Montreal.
You would think, just in terms of the number of seats, the C-Series could be a fit for the venerable Northwest DC-9 fleet, but who knows?
All right.
Sorry. The other thing that Ostrower does mention in the article, which is, I think, completely on target, is this could potentially help with utilization. I mean, if you have two aisles, you would assume that it would be more efficient for boarding. So, I mean, if this would aid in quick turnarounds, I mean, that the line's always, if the plane's sitting on the ground, it's losing money. So when you have airlines already pushing, you know, 12, 13-hour utilization, I mean, if an airplane does, you know, 5 flights a day and you could save off, you know, 5-10 minutes each leg, potentially, I mean, that's really good.
Yeah, it's a big deal. And I think John mentions in the article that this is something that would be appealing to Southwest, that kind of lives on fast turnaround. And so if there's a different kind of an aircraft configuration in that passenger class, or that class of size, an airline like Southwest would be very, very interested in that configuration.
I think absolutely. I figured it out, guys.
Okay, David.
What, how are they going to board faster?
No. I figured out the engine problem on the 737.
Okay.
They need to make a Fokker 614, put the engine on top of the wing.
Yeah, or like the Honda jet, right?
Yeah, or the Honda jet.
Yeah, the DC-9, put the engines on the tail.
Yeah. But, of course, I mean, then it becomes more complicated than just a re-engining, because then it's a you know, airframe redesign or a larger.
But all you're doing is redesigning the wing.
the most complicated part of the whole aircraft, right?
Well,
yeah. No, but I hear you.
If this ends up happening, I really want Boeing to draw flames on it or something, or like a unicorn. It'd be visually appealing.
It would have quite an effect, certainly.
And imagine it when they're deplaning. What if they had instead of stairs, or even jetways, what if they had a chute and you could just slide people out the chute and they'd slide right into the terminal?
You could hand
a beer dispenser next to it.
That's right. Yes.
Hey, you're giving Ryanair ideas. Stop it.
All right. Well, listen, we've heard from Boeing that the outlook for pilots and mechanics is pretty rosy. We see an interesting design potentially for future aircraft. And that's
797, I guess that would have to be, right?
That could be. That could be.
You know, I've wondered this since I was like 8. What happens when they run out?
Well,
they shut down.
That is a good question.
Yeah, well, they can't go back to 707. And of course, they took the McDonnell Douglas design and made the 717. So
they'll have to go to the 800s.
With Airbus, you have the 300s done, the 310s done, 320, 330, 340, 350. I mean, they're 60, 70, and 90, so I guess they have a bit more room, but sorry.
The general aviation industry and business aviation has not been doing as well, I think, in terms of starting to come back. The next article is an indication of that. This is from the Associated Press. Cessna cuts 700 jobs, blames stalled recovery. And last week, Cessna announced that they were going to cut an additional 700 jobs. The CEO of Cessna, Jack Pelton, says that this is a result of a lackluster economy. The article also points out that since late in 2008, Cessna has really cut half its workforce, some 8,000 jobs. Rob, you were just out in Wichita, weren't you, recently?
Yes, yes. And they were, that was just the few days before the vote was taken to see if the workers were going to strike.
Right.
And, of course, they didn't. This might have something to do with why they didn't. Pretty tough to be on strike for more when you have people losing their jobs.
Sure.
But as I understood, too, many of the folks that were affected by this, these cuts were related to the single engine aircraft. I thought it had something to do with the Columbia or the Corvallis, which is still being built up in Oregon. But you know, the point is that I think everybody thought that maybe this year it was going to start getting a little better. Orders have, and I was talking to one jet manufacturer who now is not measuring their progress in terms of orders. They're measuring it in how many are not being canceled.
Wow.
So, yeah. You know, it's kind of a backhanded comment about where the industry is headed. But business aviation has always lagged the airline industry.
Yeah. Well, it's not in this article, but I also see, Rob, from there's also Hawker Beechcraft. Just this last Friday announced some layoffs, additional layoffs, 350 salaried employees at Hawker Beechcraft. So It's tough. It's very tough.
Rob, here's my question to you. Any chance these jobs come back, or are they all, if they come back, it's not going to come back in Wichita?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question because that was one of the issues that was going on before the strike vote was taken a couple of weeks ago, is that, you know, the story that Molly from the Wichita Eagle, Molly McLennan, wrote about the potential results of the strike was that if these folks did strike, that they were going to be sending even more jobs to Mexico because Cessna would not be able to compete. And so at this point in time, I don't think anybody knows whether these jobs are ever going to come back or not. And I think it's all, if anybody says they will, I think it's all speculation.
Hmm. You know, Molly's on my list of potential future guests.
She's really fun to talk to. I had a chat with her when I saw her in Wichita a week before last. And like I said, she was busy gathering up facts for the strike story and all of which, you know, it is interesting because, of course, all the folks in Wichita were making comments on her column about the story, and it was probably 98% against the union.
Really?
Well, you know, you've got 10,000 people that are out of work in the aviation industry in Wichita, and you have people that are, to those folks, squawking about having to see their health care costs go up 10%. I mean, and that's subsidized health care costs on top of it.
Mm.
And they want a job... job security. Hey, listen, I wish I had job security.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, and that's what the people in town saw that as, a group of individuals just not being realistic. And it was pretty fiery stuff on her blog there.
Hmm. All right, we have a couple of articles to finish up the news concerning some aviation accidents. The first is from Associated Press, Sparks Flying, Wings Aground, New York City Flight Lands Safe. And this is a recent event, Delta Connection. This was Flight 4951, which was operated by Atlantic Southeast Airlines. And this was working its way from Atlanta to White Plains and experienced a problem with one of the landing gear, one of the wing landing gear, which would not deploy. This was the right landing gear. So the pilot had a little conversation with air traffic control. The passengers were told to brace for impact. The plane made its landing. The emergency vehicles were all deployed and ready for the worst. And as the plane came down, the wing, of course, that didn't have its landing gear deployed, touched the tarmac, which generated a very spectacular set of sparks. There's some passenger photos out the window of the sparks, but nothing ignited. The plane, I guess, scraped to a halt safely, and everyone deplaned without incident. Rob, this was kind of a close call, wasn't it?
Well, you know, I guess the reason I threw this in there is that when we think about, you know, Dan could give us better numbers, but in terms of the number of airline flights that we have in the United States in a day, I mean, we don't really have a whole lot of problems. We really don't.
Right.
And so I just thought that some of the language that some of the folks used in the story about thinking that, you know, they were going to meet their maker, and I guess, yeah, if I were in the back and I was not familiar, I'd probably be scared too. But I'm just saying, really, this does not happen often at all.
Extremely rare.
It really doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, air travel is, most ways that you might measure it, is actually quite safe.
Well, that's actually why, you know, I've heard the argument occasionally, you know, why do people focus on airplane crashes so much when X number of people die each year on highway accidents? Is because they're just so rare.
Right.
But then the other thing, Rob, I mean, you know, if I am ever in an airplane accident and, you know, it's really bad, I will take comfort in saying, well, Rob says this doesn't happen too often, so it'll make me feel that much better.
Did you see that TV series on NBC last week, The Event?
Oh, God, I'm already obsessed with it.
Oh, my Lord. I mean, it was interesting the way they used the airplane. If you didn't see it, we won't give it away, but another interesting show about airplanes. But again, I think it is important that now if general aviation could just get its safety record up to something like that, it would be a wonderful thing, but it has a long way to go.
You know, I showed my wife the picture of that the passenger took out the window of the shower of sparks, and her reaction to that photo was, why would a passenger be looking out the window in a situation like that, and why wouldn't they have their head firmly planted between their legs?
That's a good question.
I guess this is natural inclination to not avoid the excitement, you know, safety versus excitement, I guess.
Or 5 minutes of fame on YouTube.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I guess you can have your head between your legs and sort of like stick the camera up.
I guess you could try.
Yeah, but also, don't you think it's people saying, oh, this isn't going to be that big a deal. Come on. This doesn't happen very often. How bad can it be? So we're going to scrape a little wingtip.
Oh, man. I'd just be thinking about where the fuel is, which is in the wing, and what the end result was most likely to be. That's a scary situation, I think. But
would scare me. Well, in fact, there's no worse. If you have to have a landing gear issue from the cockpit, you'd rather have both gear not come down rather than have one come mm-hmm. down and one up, because the chances of, you know, almost instantaneously losing control of the airplane are so great when you have one up and one down.
Right, because it's not a symmetric kind of situation.
No, there's no balance. It's going, as soon as it touches down, it's going to grab that wingtip, and if you have too much speed, you're worried about it cartwheeling. And
yeah,
then
exactly.
You are going to meet your maker.
But in all fairness, don't you think that we're probably worse off in an accident like that, or when something like that's happening, because we do know what the consequences are? And we know what we're looking at.
That's a good point, David.
Compared to a passenger who, yeah, there's a problem, but in this case, sometimes ignorance is bliss.
Yeah, a little more comforting. Let me ask you this, Rob. If you had a choice between landing an airplane that with a nose gear that didn't deploy or the two wing gears that didn't deploy, what situation would you prefer?
Oh, I'd rather have the nose gear not come down. Because you can control the airplane. If you can get it down on the mains, you can get the airplane pretty slow before nose touches down.
Yeah, and I think we've seen that.
And so you could be down to 60 knots, 70 knots before the nose came down, and by then it's just about going to stop. And there's really nothing to catch fire in the nose usually. But the mains, oh my God, you know, you worry, are you going to tear open a wing tank? And that's where it gets really scary.
Or if you're really lucky, you're flying a CH-53 Sea Stallion and you hover over the deck and they reach up and they manually lower the gear so you can set the aircraft down.
That's true, yes.
I bet that's happened.
That's happened.
Yeah. Okay, our last article comes from a site. Actually, this is lawyersandsettlements.com. This is Rob, do you normally read that? That source. This is pilot error.
No, actually, I didn't even know about this until I saw this story. I thought that was kind of interesting, actually.
This says pilot error, air traffic controller distraction resulted in plane crash. And this is about that private plane versus helicopter collision that occurred last year in August 2009 in New York City. That accident resulted in the loss of, nine people on those two airplanes. But the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, has a report out that says that neither of the pilots could see each other's aircraft until just before they collided. And at the same time, the air traffic controller was reportedly on a personal phone call while he was directing the traffic, and he was unable to give pilots the information they needed for the air traffic in that area. I don't know. Sounds like the controller issue is the big contributor to this accident.
Well, I think that when you look at the facts, though, I think it also shows that the radar track that they had showed that the helicopter was only on the controller's scope for about, I think it was under 10 seconds before they ran together. And they were approaching each other. I think the helicopter came up from beneath and caught the airplane, if I'm not mistaken. And they were kind of each in each other's blind spot. And now, now could the controller have warned this guy if he had not been on a phone call? Absolutely. If he happened to be looking at his scope at the moment that helicopter came up on the freak, you know, or on the scope, but you don't know that would have happened either. So, I'm not condoning the fact that the guy was on a phone call. It's kind of a stupid thing to be doing, but we can't say for any certainty that he would have seen it had it been on the scope a little earlier, maybe, but maybe not.
Well, Rob, I mean, you know something about air traffic control. Is 10 seconds, is that a significant period of time or length of time in that kind of?
10 seconds, let me think here. 10 seconds is about four sweeps of the radar.
Okay.
And so you could be watching an aircraft cross. Now realize that this was not a radar controller. This was a VFR tower guy whose main job is to keep air traffic separated on the airport and in the takeoff landing mode, not when they're, you know, 10 miles away, you know, going down the river. And so again, and I think that's the part that, as much as I don't always take the controller's side, and I can't in this case because he was on the phone, still, I mean, that controller's primary job is at the airport, not being a radar controller. And at least I don't believe they are. I think that is just strictly a VFR tower. But you know, again, and in that corridor, it's still a see and be seen. That's the way the VFR traffic is set up, except for one thing that no one has been able to answer for me yet. And I was under the impression that going up and down the river there, that fixed wing traffic was supposed to be at one altitude.
Right,
and
yes.
Helicopter traffic was supposed to be at another.
Lower
so
altitude.
So somebody was also not at the altitude they were supposed to be at. And I don't know which one it was. Maybe one of our listeners. Who's our New York air traffic? Who's our New York guy?
Phil.
Phil Turner.
Oh, Phil. I'm sorry. Yeah. Duh. Yeah, fix that. So, Phil, if you're listening, maybe you can chime in on that and tell us about the traffic pattern there going up and down the river out of Teterboro. Because I think there was a little more to it than that. Although, again, you cannot condone the fact that the guy was on the telephone. That's just crazy.
Yeah, that's tough. Okay.
In much more important news, I will be meeting Phil this week. So that's
oh, really?
The most important part of the podcast. Yeah.
Well, say
tell
hello for
we
us.
Expect an answer then to our question.
That's
absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, as we mentioned at the start of the show, we've got some recordings of various sorts, some from us, some from our listeners. Wanted to start out with one from one of our listeners. This is from Kimon. He writes in to say he's a big fan of the show. He recorded a quick message from a zero-G weightless flight that he recently participated in. He's a math teacher, and they went up for 10 parabolas with some other teachers. And this is through the Northrop Grumman Weightless Flights of Discovery program. He made a recording, and which we'll listen to in a second, but he also passed along a little bit of facts about this event. He said the plane's a 727-200 freighter. It's got a padded interior, as you might hope. And there's a few seats and a few rows of seats in the back for the flight up. It says they always fly with full fuel to keep the plane more stable. That's kind of interesting. And for the zero G part of the trip, they drop about 8,000 feet in 30 seconds, which is
16,000 feet a minute. That's pretty quick.
That's pretty good. So Kimon sent in a brief recording.
Hi, this is Kimon reporting for the Airplane Geeks podcast from the Gulf of Mexico desk. I'm at, I think, about 30,000 feet on the Zero-G Corporation G-Force 1 727-200, wing-leaded and operated for zero-gravity flights. I'm a math teacher. I teach Algebra 1 to my wonderful ninth graders at Greater Gentilly High School. And Northrop Grumman Corporation sent me up here with the Weightless Flights of Discovery program. Had an amazing time today. We did about, I think, about 10 parabolas in zero gravity and a couple of lunar and Martian gravity parabolas. An amazing experience, once-in-a-lifetime feeling. I'm a big fan of the podcast and wanted to make sure I filed a report from up here in G-Force 1. Bye-bye. Have a great one, folks. I love the show. Bye-bye.
That's pretty cool.
Isn't that great?
Now, the bar has now been set, so now I expect a listener segment from space.
Yeah, that's right. From Virgin Galactic, our first Virgin Galactic trip report.
Actually, we might be able to do that.
Oh, we might.
The CEO of Virgin Galactic was at this conference I was at down in Wichita last week and gave a very interesting chat about the fact that it's only $200,000 for the flight.
Right.
And so me, being the chatty guy that I am, when he got through describing how the whole flight would go, I said, and how long is the actual space portion of this?
Yeah.
He said, about 5 minutes.
Wow.
I said, 5 minutes?
But I bet it's a wonderful 5 minutes.
It's a two-hour flight, most of which is spent getting the, my gosh, what's the name of the airplane?
The Enterprise.
Well, I thought the carrier aircraft.
The White Knight.
The White Knight. That's what I was thinking. And the Enterprise is the center section. And it takes quite a while to get it up. I guess to go up to 50,000 feet. And then they release it, and the rocket fires. And, of course, then you've got to consider the time to get back in and re-enter. And the whole thing is only 5 minutes. So what is that? That's $40,000 a minute to go into space.
I think it might be worthwhile. Well, I also suspect that the zero-G experience is probably – a lot less expensive. You can find out the website for that organization. It was an organization, but their website is www.gozerog.com. And also, Kimon mentioned that he's got a blog up where he and another teacher are kind of documenting the experience, and it's a place where students can publish what they create. And we'll put a link in the show notes at airplanegeeks.com. But that blog is a little confusing. c.klhi.net/0g. Z-E-R-O-G.
Yeah.
I really hope there's a hyperlink in the show notes.
Yeah, yeah. It's not like jetwine.com or...
or things in the sky.
So,
K-L... Right. And if you didn't get it, go to the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, next up, I was at the Simsbury Airport fly-in in Connecticut. This was kind of my first general aviation sort of fly-in, and I was—I mean, it's no Oshkosh, but I was really impressed. I guess there was probably—I don't know—a couple hundred airplanes that came in. Fun event, but one of the interesting things was the Terra Fugia was there, and this, of course, is the car that flies, or maybe it's the airplane that you drive. And I spent just a couple of minutes with Carl Dietrich, who's one of the co-founders, and he's the CEO of Terra Fugia. Actually, Carl is a private pilot himself, comes from MIT's Department of Aeronautics and Astronautics. And that's where development started on the Terra Fugia in 2005. So here's my little interview with Carl. All right, I'm here with Carl Dietrich. Carl, you're the CEO of Terra Fugia?
That's correct, yep.
And also, John, how do you say your last name, John?
Telfian.
Okay, great. And we're standing here, actually. We're looking at the airplane itself. Can you tell our listeners, where do we stand in terms of sort of design, development, production, certification? Where are we in the process?
Sure. Terra Fugia's transition is in the midst of our development program. We have completed the proof of concept, taken the lessons learned, we've improved the design of the transition. We're now in the process of building our next generation prototypes.
And the next generation, how are they different than the initial designs?
Well, you'll notice that there are a number of refinements to the design. The biggest thing that you'll notice is that there's no canard on the front of the vehicle.
Yeah.
So that's the most obvious change. When we isolated the outer mold line of the proof of concept vehicle, we had assumed that the vehicle would be classified as a passenger car.
Okay.
And a passenger car has a requirement for a full-width bumper on the front and back. And so that was actually one of the original drivers for the canard. And further conversations with the NHTSA over the past few years have brought to light that it's probably more appropriate to categorize this as a multi-purpose vehicle, like an SUV.
Okay.
Because it's intended for off-road use, occasional off-road use.
So, I guess so.
That's a more appropriate classification for the transition.
What's proven to be the more difficult certification path, the automobile or the airplane?
Well, I would have to say that it's the combination of the two that really makes for a lot of challenges, but there are quite a few more regulations on the automotive side than there are on the aviation side.
Sure.
So it requires more work to ensure that we are fully compliant with federal motor vehicle safety standards. But finding the combination is really the challenge, and keeping it all within the strict weight limitation of the light sport aircraft category is the biggest technical challenge.
Now, you're looking for first delivery next year in 2011, first customer delivery, is that correct?
Yeah, our goal is to deliver our first product around December of 2011. Now, obviously, that's contingent upon the testing of our next generation vehicle. Right. And so if flight test and drive testing goes forward smoothly, then we would be in a position to have a first delivery around that time of year.
And when do you expect that flight testing to start? Does that start this year or wrap around?
Next year. Yeah. So first half of next year. We'll see. You know, obviously, if we find that it takes longer than expected to assemble the vehicles, if we find that we need to do some more extensive testing, if something comes up during testing, then the schedule can slip. But right now, it's our goal to fly a prototype at Oshkosh and to deliver a product by the end of 2011. We'll see.
Excellent.
We'll see how it goes.
Well, you're certainly generating a lot of interest at venues like this this fly-in. A lot of people seem to be quite interested in this kind of a concept.
Well, the concept captures the imagination. I mean, flying cars are part of the pop culture of our country, and I think having something that's practical and that's designed to fit inside the existing general aviation infrastructure as well as meet the existing Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards and something that actually has a license plate on it, it starts making people think, hey, maybe this could actually happen. Maybe it's possible. And that's exciting to a lot of people.
Absolutely. Well, terrific. We've mentioned Terra Fuji a couple of episodes of the Airplane Geeks podcast, and we'll look forward to covering it as you guys progress towards delivery. So best of luck to you.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
It was pretty interesting to get it right up to the Terra Fuji. He mentioned transition. He used that word transition several times, and that's actually the name for this the model. So the company's Terra Fuji. I think a lot of us have been calling the aircraft a Terra Fuji, but the name they've chosen for that is the transition.
Hey, Max, I think you need a filter on that mic with all that background noise.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of airplanes around landing, taking off, and taxiing around on the field.
Did they give you any idea what the Terra Fuji was going to cost?
I think they were saying about $250,000. That's what I believe I heard. They did a little demonstration where they actually activated the mechanism to fold up the wings and then drop them back down. So that's how it would transition from, the flying position with the wings down into a folded position with the wings sort of folded in half and vertical for driving on the street. And the smoothness of the mechanism, suggested to me that this was not just some quick and dirty, kind of device. It really looked like it had been well engineered. The thing doesn't fly at this point. In fact, they trailered it to the fly-in. With Carl was you heard me ask his name. It was John Telfian. I believe he's the senior engineering technician. But it also turns out he's an Airplane Geeks listener and listens to our podcast on his commute to work. But he's also a pilot and a carbon fiber guy. I see from the Terra Fuji website, which is www.terrafugia.com, that John has worked on 9 America's Cups boats. So he knows carbon fiber.
John, nice job.
Yeah.
I only have one question. And John, maybe you can call in and tell us this someday. That, I mean, it's 80 inches tall. So that is what, 6 feet, not quite 7 feet high. Would that fit in a standard garage?
Yes. In fact, that's one of the design criteria. We talked about that a little bit as well. It being a design criteria, it constrains, what you can do with the design. The trailer that they brought in is an enclosed trailer. And I also looked at that and I said, yeah, that's, it's a tight fit, but that's about the size of a garage.
Did they say where
if you can afford? If you can afford how much it costs, you can afford to hangar it, Rob. Let's put it bluntly.
Yeah, probably. But the team itself is very interesting. Carl's wife Anna is also from MIT. She has experience at GE Aviation and at Boeing's Phantom Works. So they've got a talented crew working on this. So it'll be pretty exciting to see how this progresses.
Since you mentioned that John is a listener, which is really cool. I think the most important question is, when will we be receiving our review copy?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah. Well, their shop or their factory or their offices, I'm not sure what is in Massachusetts, in a Boston suburb. So not too far away from us, Dan. We may have a field trip in our future.
Ah, I like the way you think, sir.
Absolutely.
Rob, pick me up. We'll meet in Hartford, and the four of us will get together.
There we go. I'm game, definitely game. All right, we'd like to move on. David was recently at the full title maybe, David, is the Naval Air Station Oceana Air Show. Is that right?
Well, actually, it would be the Naval Air Station Oceana Open House.
Open House. And this is at, what, Virginia Beach?
Beautiful Virginia Beach. It's about 5 miles inland on the Virginia Peninsula.
And is this an annual air show?
It's always the second or third weekend in September, like clockwork.
Great.
So it's usually good weather. This year's weather was spectacular. Oceana is the largest naval jet base in the country. You always have at least 5 or 6 F-18 squadrons now based there. not to mention NAS Norfolk is only 2.7 flight minutes away. So all of their stuff from NAS Norfolk shows up for demonstrations and on static display.
Cool. So, David, you recorded a number of different interviews here. I don't know if we'll have time to go through all of them. So maybe start out with a couple of your favorites. Where would you like us to start?
Let's go old school first. Let's start off the Virginia Fighter Factory and the Military Aircraft Museum in Virginia brought in a pair of, I won't spoil the fun, but high-performance aircraft from their museum. The interview is pretty self-explanatory. It's the two pilots talking about their high-performance aircraft that they brought in.
Okay, let's listen to David.
Hi, folks. I'm sitting in a double-decker bus on the flight line at Naval Air Station Oceanic, not kind of what I was expecting to be doing interviews in, but sitting across from me is Boom Powell. Boom came in a very high-performance aircraft this morning. Boom, you want to tell me what you arrived at NAS Oceanic in?
Right, first of all, I love the sarcasm. I arrived in an Avro 504K, a replica, obviously. The replica was built in Argentina. Got a modern engine. It's got a modern Rotec engine in it. It looks nice and round, about 115 horsepower, I think. Give it a good look.
How long did it take you to fly from your home base?
8 miles away, and it took me about 20 minutes of flying time to get here. Wind was a little bit of a factor, and what we had to do, because there's no radio in the Avro, is we followed a steerman over. And the steerman was kind of our communications link to make sure we were cleared to land. I could barely keep up with the steerman, so that'll show you what a kind of a kite that airplane is.
But it is beautiful, and my understanding is it's not full-size, correct?
No, it is full-size. That is a full-size Avro 504K. The triplane that we brought here is full-size as well.
And Boom, tell me about you a little bit about your aviation career.
Oh, you're talking to one of the luckiest men alive. Absolutely terrific. First of all, I was a Navy carrier aviator. I began with that. I flew both Skyhawks and then later on Vigilantes, plus a handful of stuff. I was based here at Oceana for about 5 years when I was a fighter adversary squadron here, VF-43, and did that. And then as the years went by, I discovered that the airline hiring age had caught up with my age, and I went to a little company called Pan American. And through a quirk in the bidding system, after some time playing commuter games, I wound up being in a 747. After Pan American died, I went to a cargo company called Atlas Air, which is still out there and doing its thing. So did that, and then the FAA in its wisdom told me that I was too old to fly big airplanes anymore. So I said, okay, forgot that. I got a job flying Learjets, and forget the leather seats and the gold fixtures and the things. This was across the river with Flight International and military stuff for contracts, and the airplanes were stripped, but we had pods on them. It looked like we were carrying rockets. And that was a lot of fun. Did a little bit of that. Got my flight instructor's rating somewhere through that. Kind of flew everything that was available. I'm a writer. I've got a series of magazine articles. Those of you that regularly follow Flight Journal or subscribe to the Tailhook. I'm the guy that does the catwalk column. So you got that going. Researching an article, I wound up working for Air Combat USA. These guys that go up and make fighter pilots for a day. So I'm too old to fly big airplanes, but I go out and haul G's in the weekend. And then in the middle of all this, I was fortunate enough to meet Jerry Yagan. And kept talking around, hanging around, volunteering to do this, that, and the other thing. And now I'm one of his pilots. I get to fly things like the triplanes, the Avro, and the Stearman, and all this other good stuff he's got.
So let's see. I heard A4. I heard Vigilante A5, which was the largest jet fighter they ever put on the deck of a carrier.
You got to say that. You got to say that. Because the A3 Sky Warrior was as heavy as we were. Actually, they launched a little bit heavier. We came aboard at the same weight. They had a longer wingspan. We were a foot longer in length, but they weren't nearly as fast. So the largest and fastest jet to operate off of aircraft.
A5s or RA5Cs?
RA5Cs. But the A5A, the bomber version, the A3J, only lasted for, 2 years, a little over 2 years.
Your Vigilante combat tour was in Vietnam?
Of course. The first one. My first was A4s first. I went to Vietnam in A4s first. In a very interesting squadron based out of Alameda, and did that. And then I instructed A4s in California in 125.
Also, one of my favorite squadrons I heard mentioned was VF-43. Did you have time in both the F-5s and the A-4s, or just the A-4s?
The A-4, of course, is my ball of wax and did all that for the time, including the Mongoose, which was fun. I flew the T-38. We were just getting the F-5s, and because I was never in a VF squadron, I guess they considered I couldn't fly the F-5 or something. And I flew the T-38 as well as the A-4.
The version of the A-4 he mentioned was the Mongoose, which is the uprated engine and bigger intakes and a 1-to-1 thrust ratio, so you could outfly anybody, correct?
Basically, yeah, it was absolutely terrific. It was a nifty airplane.
We've talked about, and you flew heavy, so we've gone from an Avro this morning that refuses to land to a cargo-laden 747.
About 860,000 pounds is one of our typical takeoff weights in those things. It was terrific all over the world. Great flying.
So out of all of this, do you have a favorite?
Heck no. That's always one of those questions you guys always love to ask, and there is no good answer. Give me conditions, give me circumstances, and I'll probably pick an airplane.
There's nothing wrong with the answer that says the one I'm getting in this morning.
That's the good answer then. Yeah, it's one of these things, especially when you get to fly things like that. As far as what's here today, I got to admit I'm a little fonder of the triplane than I am of the Avro, but that's just because it's a little easier to fly.
It's a really beautiful aircraft. I appreciate it, and I love talking to you. I'm sure we could talk for hours.
Yes, we could. We'd do that.
I appreciate you taking the time, and thank you very much.
Super. No problem.
I'm in the double-decker bus, and sitting across from me right now is Nelson Esky. Nelson flew the other high-performance aircraft into the field today. Nelson, what did you arrive in?
Fokker Triplane, DR1.
A beautiful red and white DR1. Nelson, tell me a little bit about your flying career.
I just started out flying for fun in this area, Virginia Beach area, and finally got with Piedmont Airlines, flew for the airlines for 25 years, retired, and now I'm back flying little airplanes again and having a ball.
You had a little bit of a headwind. The DR1 refused to land this morning, huh?
Yeah, it was a little bit of a headwind. It's a squirrely airplane. It floats with the three wings. It has a lot of lift, so it's hard to get it on the ground sometimes.
And how long was your flight from the fighter factory?
Oh, about 15 minutes. That's all.
And you flew for Piedmont Airlines. What did you fly back then for Piedmont?
I started out with the started on the Boeing, actually, as a second officer, and then went to the Fairchild, the YS-11, back to the Boeing, and finished my career flying a 737.
Very cool. And how long have you been flying with the fighter factory?
Been almost 2 years now, about a year and a half, really, flying with the fighter factory.
What other aircraft besides the DR-1 do you get to fly for them?
I fly, we have a VAL that's on loan to us, which was in Tora Tora, the film. It's a Japanese dive bomber. I fly the Stearman, I fly the Chipmunk, I fly the PT-22, I fly the L-5, and fly the Traplane.
Any favorites out of the bunch?
They're all fun. Probably the PT-22, the Stearman, and Chipmunk in that order. The VAL's fun. It's just a big old... just a big old lumbering plane. It's really fun to fly. It has a beautiful sound and engine on it.
Do you get to do aerobatics in the PT or the Chipmunk?
No, that's one thing that the boss won't let us do. No aerobatics are allowed, which is a safety factor. I understand that. I had a Fitz for about 5 years, and so I love aerobatics, but it's more fun just flying these and not putting my fun on the line by doing something I'm not supposed to do.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time. GR1's really cool. It was a real treat seeing that fly in this morning. I appreciate you bringing it here, and hopefully we'll do some more with the Virginia Fighter Factory. I think you guys have a really good museum. They have a Aviation Institute of Maintenance facility next to it that they're teaching young guys how to build airplanes or work on airplanes by building replicas and working on things like SPADs and Fokker DR1s. Good experience for everybody. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks very much. I really enjoyed it, and I hope to see you real soon.
These guys have way too much fun. I'm so envious.
They were a cool pair, and they like talking about airplanes.
Yeah, I kind of got that.
Yeah,
wow,
clearly.
Nice job on that. That was pretty cool.
David, this is fighterfactory.com?
Yes.
Great. Okay, that was a good one. What's up next?
The next one I guess we'll do is me being a bit starstruck. I was lucky enough to get an interview with the MS-760 Paris Jets team. Two of my heroes, Snort and Jive, are thousands of hours in military high-performance jet fighters. If anyone has ever seen what they called the Cat Flight, which was an F-14, a F-4F Wildcat, an F-6F Hellcat, a F-8F Bearcat, and an F-7F Tigercat flown with a Tomcat, that was invented by Snort and led to what is now known as the Heritage Flights, where F-14s fly, F-18s fly with Corsairs, F-16s fly with P-51s, Thunderbolts fly with P-47s. It was the very start of what the Air Force and the Navy took on to become heritage flights. So these guys have thousands of hours of high-performance jet fighters, and I grew up watching Dale Snodgrass fly F-14s at Oceana at Willow Grove, and it was an honor to be able to sit down and speak to Snort and Jive.
All right, let's have a listen.
This is David. I'm here with Jive and Snort of the MS-760 team, two of my heroes. I'll start off with Jive. Jive, quickly just tell me a little bit about your career.
Oh, my career. Well, I started in 1975 flying when I was a mere 15 years old. So that started my civilian side. Sold it on my 16th birthday. License, private pilot's license on my 17th birthday. In 18 years, I was commercial instructor and then ATP at 23 on my 23rd birthday. So I did everything as absolute early as I could. Had 4,300 hours of flying time, and then I decided to go into the Air Force. So I started pilot training, graduated number one in my class, got an F-15, went to Europe to fly Eagles, and then ended up being an F-15 pilot for almost 20 years, and then retired in 2006 as the commander of the 82nd Aerial Target Squadron in Tyndall Air Force Base, where I was flying the F-4 Phantom. And that got me into air shows because during that squadron commander tenure, I was able to convince the powers that be to put the F-4 Phantom into the heritage flight for the United States Air Force program. And that got me on the road with air shows. 2005, I did 11 different show sites and got the bug. And I've had the bug ever since. So flying Phantoms, and then I got into T-33 flying with Big Dog Fowler Carey's vintage Thunderbird. And then I met Snort, and Snort and I have been in a couple of different venues, and that culminates in where we are today, which is in the MS-760 Paris Jets, two-ship formation aerobatic team that travels around the country wowing the crowds.
And Snort, how about you?
I'm the son of a test pilot who was flew for the time for Grumman. Grew up in Long Island. I started my personal flying career a little later than Jive. I was in college on an ROTC scholarship at the University of Minnesota, and the Navy paid for me to get my pilot's license. And then I went off to flight school, got selected for jets, went through Kingsville. And went through T2s and TA4s, and Carol qualified, and I was lucky enough to be the first baby out of flight school to get selected to fly the Tomcat. So I went out to Miramar and started flying, getting checked out in the Tomcat, which took about a year process, and then I went to my first squadron, which was VF-142, and then moved right here into this hangar, which we're in Hangar 500 at Oceana, and I spent probably 20-plus years in these various spaces, including the commanding officer of VF-33, which was in this exact space, and this was our briefing room, a number of years ago. So it's kind of cool to be back. From an air show perspective, I was lucky enough as a senior lieutenant to get selected to be the F-14 demo pilot, and then I managed to coerce the system over a period of 12 years to continue flying Tomcat demonstrations, which I think may be a personal for me, a Navy record anyway, an old military record for flying demos, attack demos. So that's where I really got sustained the airshow bug. Simultaneously, towards the latter part of my Navy career, while still flying Tomcat demos, I did start at the, started doing a thing called Flight of the Cats, where we flew the Kalamazoo Air Zoo guys, flying a Hellcat, a Bearcat, a Wildcat, and then a Tomcat, and a Tigercat. So we had five ships.
And just so you know, folks, this a young kid myself got to witness him do it, and it's one of those lasting memories watching all of those cats in one flight in one formation, and listening to Snort ride the throttles the whole time, trying to keep in formation with a wildcat. It's a very unique experience.
Yeah, it was a great privilege, and it was nice because we flew with the same five guys over a period of 10 years, so it wasn't like a lot of change. So we got to know each other quite well and very comfortable with each other in that very dissimilar formation. I found that in flying the formation with a Tomcat, you would think it'd be easier to fly with the wings forward, but I found that if I actually flew with the wings back and we're going on the average of about 195 knots, that the induced drag, because of essentially flying a swept wing airplane, allowed me to be, though I had a pretty high angle deck angle on the airplane, I was able to be higher up on the power, therefore the formation was easier to keep. So anyway, it was a great time, and that led until 1996, actually here at Oceana as the wing commander for the F-14s. And I, of course, had to abuse the system as much as possible and set up my own demo team. And then that year was special because John Ellis and I did the thing called the Flight of the Twin Cats. He leading in the Tiger Cat, and I'm in the Tomcat. And we did some unprecedented things that year in that we did a formation takeoff with a civilian fighter, World War II fighter, and a modern fighter. And then we did formation aerobatics together. So the slot roll and the Cuban and all kinds of things in totally dissimilar airplanes. So that was a pretty special year for me. I think we flew about 20 shows that year. I think we flew 15 or 16 twin cat shows, and then did a couple others with just the big flight of the cats. So that led to my last tour was up in Washington, but while I was in that tour in legislative affairs up on Capitol Hill, I was also flying air shows. So I had to thank Congress for having a wonderful work week, which was from Tuesday to Thursday, because all the members leave on Thursday night and they come back on Monday night, which worked perfectly for an air show pilot in the Navy. So I flew a number of air shows those years in the T-6 and the Corsair, all from Kalamazoo. And then when I retired, I got sponsorship, decided to go full-time in the air show circuit, and I got a nice sponsorship from AT&T, and then started flying the F-86 primarily. And then did that for, 6 or 7, 8 years. And then simultaneously the Heritage Flight program came on board, during that same time frame. And so I've been flying the Heritage Flight with the Air Force, getting my joint credit and exchange tour pilot, program done. But they've done that for almost 11 years now. So that's been a great thrill and a privilege. And then this year, so up until this point, I basically have either been in a military formation or doing solo, aerobatics. And then this year, Jive and I had the opportunity to get these Paris jets and sort of bring a new airplane to the circuit and also show to the world that the four-place sort of 57 Chevy jet is very cool.
Jive, you want to tell us a little bit more about these four-place biz jets that you guys are doing loops, rolls, and other things in?
Well, it's the ultimate family truckster, and we use that term a lot. But it is also the very first very light jet, you know, before the term was really coined with airplanes like the Eclipse and the Honda Jet and things like that. The Paris Jet was out there in the late 50s being put together with the exact same mission that these airplanes are today. So it's a 300-knot airplane in cruise. It cruises in the mid-20s with a pressurized cabin, fully air-conditioned system. You can haul four people approximately, 800 to 1,000 miles, depending on your fuel configuration. And, with the tailwind. And then with the right certification, you can do what we can do with them. It's basically a four-place L-39, if some of your listeners know the performance capabilities of an L-39. In fact, we do formation takeoffs, formation landings with L-39s, and it's the exact same power to weight ratio with the airplane. So very maneuverable, and then we put them together with the in close formation and with some very unique smoke systems, a dual pump system that we can put out massive amounts of smoke, and it makes for a very graceful, elegant ballet in the sky.
A couple more questions and we'll be done. Tell me what it's like to fly it as an aerobatic airplane. How is it handled in the formation?
The airplane is actually very nice aerobatically in formation. When you fly formation or aerobatics, there's two primary things you want to look at is the pitch rate of the airplane. Is it very heavy in pitch? This airplane is exceptionally light and precise in pitch, so any kind of vertical maneuvering the airplane is absolutely wonderful. It is predictably a little bit heavy in aileron. So in other words, it rolls a little bit slow and a little bit heavy as far as stick forces. But with the application of rudder, little rudder with it, it comes around very nicely. So it's a very, very formation. It's a very stable airplane to fly. And from a lead perspective, it's very nice because it's just the airplane flows nicely. It's not a ratchety kind of airplane. So it flows into our maneuvers very nicely. And once we
come in and get up our what I call our head of steam as we come downhill and start a routine, it then sustains its energy quite well. If I do my normal routines in, say, a Mustang or a Corsair, I lose energy faster. So I have to make sure my vertical stuff, very vertical stuff, is in the beginning and then slowly transition to more flat maneuvers and the rolling maneuvers. This airplane is able to sustain the vertical stuff longer. Just it's just a great airplane to fly. And with our, like Jive said, it has awesome smoke system. So between the two of us, it's a pretty, it makes for a very nice show.
Well, gentlemen, I won't keep you much longer because I know you got to go flying. But the amount of hours and the aircraft that have been flown in this room is completely awesome. And you're both really heroes to me because what you guys do is really cool every week. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks, David. Yeah, thank you, David. Appreciate it.
All right. I guess you can find out more about Jive and Snort at their website. That's www.teamms760.com. All right, David, thanks for those. I think maybe we'll save the rest of them for another time, if that's okay.
That's fine.
You certainly got access to quite a number of the performers.
I've learned that basically there's no harm in asking. What's the worst that'll happen is they say no and you're no better off. Everyone was great down there and went out of their way to accommodate me, and they were excited. I think we found a lot of new listeners this weekend at Oceana.
Oh, that's great. Outstanding. And with This Week in Aviation, here's David Vanderhoof again, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 2, Episode 30, September 26th through September 30th. September 28th, 1924, the four Douglas World Cruisers returned to their starting point, 175 days after they left on April 4th. Originally, the program consisted of five aircraft. The aircrafts were given the name Boston, Chicago, New Orleans, and the Seattle. The well-planned flight was not without failures. The Seattle flew into a mountain on April 30th. The crew survived and walked to safety. The Boston, Chicago, and New Orleans flew across the Pacific through Asia, the Middle East, and then on to Europe. On the flight across the Atlantic, the three aircraft hit serious weather. The Boston was lost. Its crew was picked up by the USS Richmond. Once the Chicago and the New Orleans reached the east coast of the United States, they were joined by the fifth aircraft, the test aircraft. That was christened the Boston 2. Three aircraft then flew on to Seattle to complete their world trek. The aircraft flew 23,943 nautical miles on their trip. The world crews would be equipped with both floats and conventional gear. As they went around the world, they changed them as needed. Also, the Douglas Company pre-positioned various spares like Liberty engines. The U.S. Navy went on to buy five more aircraft slightly heavier with machine guns. The three world cruisers would become part of the Douglas logo with the slogan, First Around the World. They would eventually be replaced by a representation of a Mercury Redstone rocket, which now can be seen as part of the Boeing logo. The Chicago is at the National Air and Space Museum on the Mall. The New Orleans is at the Los Angeles County Museum of Natural History. And the wreckage of the Seattle is located in Alaska in a museum. September 28, 1928. Juan de la Cerva flies his autogyro C-8L over the English Channel. While an autogyro is a rotorcraft, the rotor is always in auto-rotation. Forward thrust is usually come from a radial engine. It was the success of the C-8 that caused the U.S. to import two. One was for the U.S. Army. The second went to Harold Pitcairn of Horsham, Pennsylvania, built under license. The Truculent Turtle, an XP-2V1 Neptune, the Turtle was the third production airframe, Bureau number 89082, takes off from Perth, Australia on September 29, 1946. The plane had just about every space filled with fuel tanks and required a rocket-assisted takeoff, or RADO, to get off the ground. The Turtle had a crew of five, four humans, and one gray kangaroo. The kangaroo was a gift for the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. The flight lasted 55 hours and 18 minutes when they finally touched down in Columbus, Ohio. The flight covered 11,236 miles. It held the record for the longest unrefueled flight and lasted until a B-52 broke it in 1962. The truculent turtle can be found at the National Museum of Naval Aviation in Pensacola, Florida. Oh, and Dan, the definition of truculent is aggressively self-assertive.
Thank you.
And last but not least, September 30th, 1968, the hangar doors opened at Everett Field in Washington State to reveal the very first Boeing 747. The city of Everett can be found at the Seattle Museum of Flight. And first flights that occurred during the week of September 26th through September 30th. The McDonald F-101 Voodoo flew on September 29th, 1954. And the de Havilland DH-100 Vampire, September 30th, 1943. And that's the way it was September 12th through the 30th.
Thank you, David.
Crazy idea. Okay, somehow we get millions of dollars, which is the easy part. Then we buy an RV and we go to all these museums that David mentioned. We can have like the remote Airplane Geeks Command Center.
That's like the road trip of the century.
Yeah. So basically, listeners, someone buy like 30,000 t-shirts and we'll be on our way.
Speaking of road trips, remember our listener, Richard, who, this was kind of a while ago, wrote in asking for recommendations. He was coming to the U.S. from the U.K. He was asking for recommendations as to...
Yeah.
Well, guess what? Richard did come and visit the United States. He didn't visit us, but get this. We got an email from him, and he mentioned some of the places he went. He was at the Boeing factory, the Aviation Museum in Seattle. He was at NAS Point. Is it Mugu?
Point Mugu.
Point Mugu, okay, for an air show where he saw the Thunderbirds. He was in San Diego at the Midway Carrier Museum. Palm Springs, he was at a museum near the airport. He went to the Pima Air and Space Museum, my personal favorite, and also the Davis-Monthan Air Force Base. And he also went to the Smithsonian.
Man, put a few miles on a car there somewhere.
He absolutely did, and he saw some really great sights. So
that is awesome.
Yeah, that really is awesome.
Oh, come on, Max. You're not going to read the comment about what he thought this NASM was?
Go ahead.
That made my week. Now I understand what it's like to be in David's head.
Oh, is that what he said? Yeah, that's great.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, September 24th, 2010. Well, g'day folks, it's Steve here for the Australian News Desk for episode 116 of the Airplane Geek Show, and joining me from some far-flung location is Grant McHaren. Where are you, mate?
Oh, that's right, mate. I'm our roving reporter, and today I'm standing on the edge of the tarmac here at Coolangatta Airport. Code is Yankee Bravo Charlie Gold, G for Gold. Well, I said G for Gold Coast, which is where it also actually is, and what you can hear in the background is one of the refueling trucks and the Jetstar A321 taking off. I've come up here for family reasons, but I'm still working, and so naturally, what does one do when one has a bit of time on the Gold Coast? You come down to the airport and hang out.
Absolutely. Could think of nothing better.
Indeed. So, there's going to be a bit of aircraft noise in the background today, but that's life. But, the Gold Coast is a very interesting part of the world. It's just on the border of New South Wales and Queensland, just to the south of Brisbane. A lot of beaches, thus the Gold Coast name. So you get lots of beaches, lots of surf. Generally, you have some pretty good weather, although where we're staying at the Tweed Heads is renowned for being a bit wet and rainy. And when Brisbane is on water rationing, they're sort of like throwing water away because it's just everywhere over there. Mm-hmm. And it's just one hill away from the water rationing area. It's rather amusing, that.
Well, you know what they say about Queensland. Do they still say beautiful one day, perfect the next up there, Grant?
I think they're trying to, but I don't know if it's getting away with it anymore. Oh, I'm just watching a GA8 air van do a nice, very slow landing at the moment.
Now look away from the runway, Grant. Look away from the runway and let's get this done.
Okay.
Now, seeing as you haven't got your laptop with you, we'll have to wing this. Grant, probably the big news this week, and we'll try not to confuse them this week, Virgin and Etihad. Looks like the deal has got the nod after looking pretty dodgy last week. It looks like it's got the nod after all.
That's right. The ACCC have given approval to the Virgin and Etihad alliance. It's preliminary approval. It's not the full official approval, but it's at least indicated that they're not going to take Qantas' objections on hand. Qantas did turn around and object to Virgin and Etihad having an alliance, which is rather amusing, as Qantas has had an alliance with British Airways into Europe for a very long time. And as if that wasn't enough, now we're hearing word that Jetstar is starting to look at expanding its global presence through alliances as well. So how can this be a bad thing if Qantas are doing it already and want to do it even more?
You know, like we said last week, Grant, it's, you know, Qantas is all right if we do it, but not if anybody else does.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Now, of course, Grant, this is not final approval. It's more like tentative approval. And in an article that I'm reading here, Grant, that's in The Australian this week, there's a quote here from the regulator that says, the ACCC is aware that consumers who book on one of the new services during the period of interim authorisation are likely to be affected if the final authorisation is denied. So it might be a case of buyer beware, although there would have to be some sort of protection put in there. In fact, Virgin and Etihad are saying that. They're saying that if you buy a ticket on one of these proposed new services and the final decision doesn't go their way, then they're still going to look after you. So, and one would imagine that they really couldn't do anything else. So they're sort of taking the risk here and hoping for the best.
Yeah, look, it's not the first time that alliances have been shut down and people have been booked post the date of the alliance collapse, in which case what's wound up happening is they've organised flights on other services and things and rebooked people and given them some vouchers and things like that. So I don't see this not happening. I think it's going to happen. But you never know with the ACCC, so fingers crossed, and I'd be booking if I had the money to go overseas, mate.
Yeah, you and me both, mate. But the upshot of this is, according to John Borghetti, the boss of Virgin, is that between the two airlines, they'll be offering 27 weekly services between Abu Dhabi and Australia, and that includes twice daily services between Abu Dhabi and Sydney and daily services to Melbourne. Six per week to Brisbane.
Yep.
Now, this is kicking off from February 2011. So, yeah, and actually an interesting little side tidbit here, Grant. This will mean that V Australia will be the first carrier to operate direct flights to the Middle East from Australia since 1991.
Wow, that's impressive news. Because, of course, we've had direct flights from the Middle East to Australia, but no Australian carrier is doing direct flights. So good on V Australia. Hopefully that one all comes together for them.
Okay, Grant, and we're probably going to have to rely on some very informed commentary from David after this segment runs, because we're not actually 100% full bottle on this particular variant. But according to the Australian Aviation Magazine website, the first Royal Australian Air Force F/A-18F Plus has taken to the skies in St. Louis. Now, they're saying here that this is the first of 12 of this specific type. They've got special wiring conduits and avionics racks, and this will allow them to be converted, if the government so chooses at some point in the future, to be upgraded to the EA-18G Growler electronic attack aircraft spec.
Right, it's those ones. Okay, so they've called them the F Plus. I was wondering what they were going to do with them, because yeah, Australia has decided that they're not going to lock out the Growler. They may get it, but they're not 100% sure. And what they've done, yeah, as you're saying there, what they've done is they've set up some of their aircraft to have all the plumbing, you might say, to be ready to become a Growler if they do go and get the extra pods and the extra internal equipment. So that's great news. They've actually called it the F Plus. I didn't realise they were going to do that. I thought it was just going to be a special case. Amazing.
Yeah, it's interesting, Grant. When I first saw this article, it popped up in my one of my RSS feeds today, and it said the first F/A-18F flies for the RAF, and I'm thinking, hang on a minute, there's already about a dozen of them here, so that can't be right. Until I saw that it was the F/A-18F Plus spec, so that's really interesting. And the picture that we see here of aircraft, which is A-44-213, it's already painted up with six squadron markings on the tail fins. Now, six squadron, for those who don't know, is currently an F-111 squadron based up at Amberley in Queensland. So there's no doubt about where that aircraft is going. It's been kind of interesting to watch how the RAF is going to position these aircraft to, you know, to take over the role of the F-111, because obviously these aircraft, I guess, weren't specifically designed to perform exactly the same roles as an F-111 was. In fact, it was interesting. We were joking around with Matt Hall recently, who was an F/A-18 pilot, and we asked him, Grant, if he'd ever flown in an F-111, and he sort of joked and said, oh, yes, I've flown in a B-111 before. So we thought that was pretty funny.
The F-111 has been able to project Australia's air power to a very large part of the world, especially in the parts north of Australia, with its extremely long range and its very low-level, not stealthy, but low-level penetration of airspace by staying masked by terrain. So replacing it has always been on the cards as something very, very difficult, and acknowledged they couldn't actually really replace the aircraft. But what they're doing is replacing the F-111's precision long-range strike with standoff cruise missiles, so the Super Hornets will get it in close enough with tanking that they can airborne release them, or even off a P-3 Orion or from one of the Navy's ships, and those cruise missiles can go and do what the F-111 used to do with bombs.
And it's just as well that we're getting all those new tanker aircraft. Oh, but let's not go there, Grant.
Yeah, well, the MRTT is going along pretty well as far as I'm aware. They're, you know, chalking up the runs on that project, so I'm looking forward to seeing those when they come in. And in fact, a contact we had in the Royal Australian Air Force has gone from deep south Victoria all the way up to Amberley. Apparently, he's going to be transferring onto the tank force. I don't think he's going to be a pilot at this stage, but I believe he's got his sights set on flying right or left seat in the MRTT, which would be good for him.
Awesome.
As a bit of a segue here we've got Australia getting the latest of the coolest of the Super Hornets as we wait for the super cool F-35 to finally get here. And the Kiwis are still having problems with their A-4s. As many of you may know, the Kiwis got rid of their frontline combat fighter force, and they have wound up mothballing them and trying to sell them. They finally got approval from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms to be able to sell them due to the charges and the ejection seat. They had to go through all those hoops. Approval was given, but the latest news is that approval has timed out. They have not done anything with the sale, and the approval window has closed. So I'm not sure of all the exact details there. I need to do a bit more reading on that one, but it's not looking good for the Kiwi A4s. In fact, there's rumours floating around that if this all falls apart, they may actually wind up going to museums.
Yeah, well, they've been in the ground for so many years now, Grant, they might as well put them in museums.
Yeah, well, as David likes to point out, they have the avionics fit out of an F-16.
Yeah, it is rather sad what happened to the New Zealand Air Force, but we've talked about that many times in the past, Grant. Probably before your mobile phone craps out there, Grant, it's a little bit windy and a little bit difficult to hear you, so just give us a bit of a quick trip report. You must have flown up with, was it Virgin or Jetstar?
Oh, no, it was definitely Virgin. We flew up Virgin, but unfortunately I forgot to do the seat booking the night before, so we wound up in right at the back, second row from the back, right in the kitty corner. So we had a couple of screamers around us, but we just knuckled down and got through it. It's only an hour and a half, two-hour flight. It's pretty simple. But other than that, the flight was good. The service was great. It was the typical Virgin kind of thing that we've grown to love and enjoy. So, came up last Tuesday. We're going back this Tuesday. So as you guys are listening to this, I'm probably heading on the way back down to Melbourne.
Well, Grant, I'll let you go to enjoy your holiday. Now, your partner and your son would probably like to go somewhere else besides the airport. Maybe you should go down the beach.
Oh, well, we've been doing that. We've been going down the beach. And, in fact, I've been on the balcony and or the beach a couple of times, and I think I've seen a couple of F-18s at very low level scooting up the coastal run. So, and Nikolai, being the true third or fourth generation flyboy, has been very quick to go. Though, definitely F-18's dad. I saw the twin tails.
Yeah, the kids are genius. All right, folks, we'll leave it there, and we'll wish Grant a happy holiday, and wish I was having a holiday. I could use one. But until next week, I'm Steve Fisher.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
Now, my question is that the first time ever where Grant has not done the Dateline?
Okay, you're expecting the Dateline from Grant, and instead it came from Steve.
Yes.
And actually, Dan, I have two under my belt.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You've done two Datelines?
I've done two Datelines for the Australia desk.
Oh.
I've done two episodes as co-host.
So, David, how was their F-18 reporting? Accurate?
Yeah. I got a heads up that they were going to talk about it, so I did a little bit more research. The Australians are being really smart. Right now we're in a huge block of EA-18 Growlers, which is the electronic version,
right,
to replace the Prowler. So to get their F-18s, they've decided to take these Growler aircraft and backfit them to a standard F-18F fit, but leaving all of the electronics in the boxes in. So when they get their F-35s, it'll be a very quick turnaround for them to create a Growler. They'll have a whole new squadron of Growlers, right, 12 aircraft, that they wouldn't have had if they had straight F-18Fs. It's a really smart deal, and that way we have electronic countermeasure people in the South Pacific. The government cleared it in 2009. The U.S. government cleared it in 2009. So they got to go ahead. So it's basically a plug and chug. When they decide they want to make Growlers, they got to just send them back, add the pods and some additional electronics, and they're good to go. And they've gotten another aircraft out of their purchase of 24.
Yeah, it is a clever approach. Good for them. All right, we have one more recording. This is from listener Peter Johnson across the pond.
Here's my view from across the pond. I'd like to start by saying that last week we saw the 70th anniversary of the Battle of Britain, where we looked back at the skills and heroism of the pilots who fought above the skies of southern England. In fact, the very blue skies above where I live. Pilots lost their lives, and I would like to say, let's not forget those who never came home that summer. Now on to my main topic. Last week, the UK Civil Aviation Authority published a report stating that dozens of pilots are taken ill during commercial flights each year. Last year alone, just on UK control flights, there were 32 incidents when the pilots were incapacitated, according to an article published in the UK Daily Telegraph. From the paper, and I quote, "In some instances, the planes have had to make emergency landings, such as the one into Malaga, because of food poisoning, or the pilot who collapsed due to toxic fumes in the cockpit on finals to London Gatwick." The report also shows that last December, the pilot of a Boeing 747 collapsed in the cockpit twice during a flight and had to be placed on oxygen after a suspected food poisoning incident. In fact, the airplane movie scenario seems to account for a significant number of pilot-related illnesses during flight. Luckily, with the separation of meals between the pilot flying and the second pilot, it proves that they're only human. We all have this image of the pilots being healthy, good-looking powerhouses, capable of facing immense challenges. Rob, by the way, there are always exceptions to this rule. But this issue points the inevitable finger at the recent press articles about Michael O'Leary's comments on using a single pilot to fly the aircraft, and one in which there is much debate going on all around the world. You must admit, the guy knows how to gain publicity even when the story's not about him or his airline, but I digress by giving him more airtime. Jim McCausland, the General Secretary of the British Airline Pilots Association, said that these statistics prove the importance of maintaining the existing arrangements. He said that removing the second pilot from the cockpit is an economy too far. Most incidents included nausea and fainting, which brings me to an event I had on a US Air 737 a few years ago, travelling from a snow-covered Washington to Tampa in Florida. I've never suffered from travel sickness, even when flying on a commercial journey or piloting myself in a small plane. On this flight, where we'd been delayed for most of the day due to bad weather, everyone was tired. I stayed awake, enjoying every second of watching America drift away beneath us in the dark. But the temperature suddenly got warmer and I noticed an immense urge to throw up. I've not thrown up in over 20 years, so this shocked me beyond belief. And I pushed past my two sleeping travelling companions and raced to the bathroom. I got really dizzy and I almost fainted in the bathroom and only returned to my seat when the flight attendant came to my rescue and to see if I was okay. And I probably suffered what we now know to have been a problem with cabin air quality. So, back to our pilots and getting ill during flights. Danny Fine, who is an editor of a pilot's website, says, "You can't land a plane without human intervention." Now, if I'd been flying that 737, there was no way I could have functioned in the cockpit, and we would have been doomed. But Fine also goes on to say, "You might as well tell Michael O'Leary that the next time he goes to the hospital, he can get a nurse to do the operation, because the surgeon is unwell." My point here is not to knock the suggestion of only one pilot, because with the progress of technology, who knows what will happen. But just to remind us that we put our lives in the hands of the pilots flying us. We trust them because they've gone through intensive training to give them the experience to hold on to our loved ones under their control. It's not that I think it's only down to the pilots either. Let's not forget the amazing strides that technology has made to help them do their job. You know, ILS, glide slopes, GPS, fly-by-wire, and the list is endless. It goes on and on and on. But at the end of the day, it's a human hand on the controls that most of us want to see. Remember Captain Burkill, the 777 pilot, who heroically brought the aircraft down without a single fatality when it lost total power 2 miles out from London Heathrow's 27 left, landing just inside the airport perimeter. Rather disturbingly, he was released as surplus to requirements by his employers a year later. Or Captain Sullenberger, who made a water landing on the Hudson without a loss of a single soul. Both of these examples come from heavily automated airplanes, yet it was human intervention that saved the day. Which brings me back to my starting point, really. Pilots, whether fighting for their lives or those who take us in their care every day, those famous words ring in my ears. Never has so much been owed by so many to so few, and long may it continue. This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Wow, Peter. Excellent.
Nice, huh?
That was really impressive.
Yeah, and you know, in the latest episode, Playing Crazy Down Under, Stephen Grant gave Peter a giant shout-out. I think this was episode 43, towards the end. A giant shout-out, and offered some encouragement. Well done.
Well, you know what I thought was interesting in that piece that he mentioned? That British Airways let that pilot go, that captain that put that 777 down on the end of the runway?
Yeah.
I didn't quite understand what he said the reason was.
Speaking of shout-outs, I have a shout-out of my own that I think relates to that question. And I'll come back to your point, Rob. But my shout-out is there's a new aviation podcast, a new UK aviation podcast called Flaps Podcast. And that's at www.flapspodcast.com. And it's a monthly podcast. It's produced by two pilots in the UK. As we record this, they've got two episodes out. They're 30 minutes, kind of light and fun. You can also follow them on Twitter at Flaps Podcast. Back to your point, Rob. I think one of the guests, one of their podcast episodes, is that same pilot. I'm pretty sure it's the same one. I didn't make the connection until just now, so I might be wrong. But you can actually hear the story from the mouth of that pilot, if I'm right, over at Flaps Podcast.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, worth checking out.
Just to add one last comment, what I really enjoyed about the segment is because I've been trying to be nice to Rob this podcast, so I liked how Peter made fun of Rob to fill that void.
Yeah. It just makes him one of us.
That's right. That's right. All right. Well, we'd like to thank Peter Johnson again for that Across the Pond segment. Also for Kiman for sending in his Zero G report. Really appreciated that. As always, we encourage listeners to send in audio files of their aviation experiences, whatever those may be. We'd also like to thank Steve Fisher and Grant McCarron again from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. Check them out. Actually, their most recent episode also includes some interviews with performers, some flight show performers, so you can check that out. And of course, mostly we'd like to thank you all, our listeners. Without listeners, we certainly wouldn't be doing this. All right.
So do you think it's time that I can stop clicking on the website?
Yeah,
five times a minute.
Yeah, you can let it go on its
own. Let it go now.
Natural.
Okay.
All right.
And should we shout out to Harriet? Hope you're feeling better.
Yes, Harriet. We haven't had a report from Harriet or her son Micah yet, so hopefully she's doing well. David Vanderhoof, tell people where they can find you online.
They can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com, or you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof.
And Rob Mark, how about you?
Jetwine.com, Twitter at Jetwine, and a big shout out to Dan for trying to be nice.
And Dan, Mr. Nice. We'll start calling you Mr. Nice. Where do people find your
blog? I almost prefer the sea pitch nickname that I got during Oshkosh. Let me think about that one. Anyway, you can find me online. Well, I'm sure if you work for some kind of government agency with a very high security clearance, you can find me very easily online.
You're on the list.
But for other people, Twitter, Dan Webbage, blog, thingsinthesky.com.
Great. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at 30,000feet.com. That's all written out in words. We're on Twitter at Max Flight. Be sure to see airplanegeeks.com for show notes and listener comments. Follow us on Twitter at Airplane Geeks, and you can send us email. That's to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Also, be sure to check out our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/airplanegeeks.
Well, what if they wanted to call us and leave a message?
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Binet. You can subscribe to the Airplane Geeks podcast on iTunes or the Zoom Marketplace. If you haven't yet, please go in there and leave a comment, a recommendation. That's always very helpful. That helps other people find the podcast, so we'd appreciate that.
However, if your comment is to get rid of me or Dan or David or Max, just don't waste your time.
Keep it to yourself.
Yeah, you can just take a pass on that.
Opening and closing music provided by Brother Love. Find him at www.brotherloverocks.com. All right, that's it. Join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Have a good morning.
Good morning. Or good afternoon. Whatever time you're listening.
Hasta la vista, baby. Hot as hell.
For mainline flights from, sorry, give me a second. Lost my train of thought.
It gets a lot worse when you're older.
Yeah, if you've got a train, you're lucky, Dan, let me tell you.
I'm going to bite my teeth about Oprah and a bunch of her fans coming down under because no comment. No wonder they've taken an A380, though.
Grant, really? You remember we're talking to an American audience now.
I know, but most of my American friends have the same comments about Oprah. Oh, no.
Oh, dear. Well, let's manage to alienate us from most of our fans on the Airplane Geeks. This might be our last Australia desk report for a very long time.
Oh, don't tease Dan like that.
There you go. He thinks we speak funny. Imagine if he had to fill in for us.
Oh, that would be interesting. We'd learn all about the seat pitch in JQ, QF, and DJ, which, of course, is Virgin.
And they have allowed the Virgin Etihad agreement to go ahead. The Virgin Etihad, what do you call it? That's the, what do you call that? That's a blooper. Okay.
There we go.
Yeah, sorry about the quality on this one.
No, that's all right. It gives it a nice, authentic feel.
Yeah, well, you know, man on the spot.
You should have stood there and said, I'm watching it now. Oh, the humanity.
That's hilarious.
Or the vagonity.
Rob, quick question. Just after you're talking about that, am I fun to talk to?
Are you what?
Fun to talk to, too?
Max, do we
sometimes?
I can't take the fifth, can I?
Sure you can. You just did. There's your answer, Dan.
Yes, you're fond to talk to, Dan. Sure.
Oh, thank you.
Dan, we love you.
Actually, that reminds me, we need an official Airplane Geeks constitution.
You know what I thought you were going to say? I thought you were going to say we needed an official Airplane Geeks cookie. Or food or something, usually you're trying to eat while you're... See, remember back in the old days, David, when that was me?
We, the geeks, in order to make a more perfect podcast, establish your best... I don't know. Forget it.
I was thinking more like a benevolent monarchy.
Who wants to be benevolent?
Okay, moving on.
And then if, you know... And if we don't like Max's leadership, Courtney can easily stage a coup because he has the server hosting account.
He's got the server. That's right. He can throw the switch at any moment. Oh, my gosh.
I mean, we're at someone else's mercy.
Yeah, we are. Actually,
And he's not even a Yank anymore.
That's right.